If Murray has supported the show, I'd be less sick of podcasts.
The Blubbity Blah.
Sending out good vibes.
Good vibes. Underneath breaths of deep gratitude and prayers for guidance and protection. And put on a didgeridoo and shamanic drumming track. Shivers or vibrations and stuff like that.
Okay, guys, welcome back to the Grime America Show. Coming at you this week with Sue Terry, talking about music and such. I think she was on the show back in the day, right?
No, it was a couple years ago, not too long ago, a few years ago, yeah.
Is it the second time?
Yeah, second time, yeah.
First, we got everybody's favorite podcaster over there, Graham Younger, Dryas Dunlop.
Yeah.
Put your name in the Azores ticket as Dunlop. I had to
Dunlop? Oh my God. Like, have they never heard of Dunlop? I mean, that's what it's so. And every time I pronounce it, it sounds off too. And people always like, what? How do I spell that? I'm like, Dunlop? You know, like you the tire. Good. Like the tire or like the golf ball.
Maybe they don't have Dunlop tires in the Azores.
Yeah, I guess not.
Mind you, I was talking to someone in Toronto, though. This is a 416 number.
That's not any better. I mean, that's probably worse.
But they might be sending Azorians out.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised. So, yeah, we got Sue Terry. If people want to skip ahead, of course, there's always a timestamp in the show notes. If people want to skip our lazy ramblings here, they can get straight to the interview. Click on that. Of course, we're going to do our lazy ramblings, though. Some people love this shit. Some people, I mean, lots of people skip. Lots of people say this is, sometimes they don't even listen to the interview. They just listen to the rambling. So,
that makes sense.
I mean, we just did some good rambling on our Outlawed Plus episode over there. Graham did like a half an hour segment on Cyclical Catastrophe.
Was it that far? Was it that long?
It was a good 25 minutes minimum. It might have been a half hour. Yeah, a good chunk. If people want to check that out over at GrimeAmericaOutlawed.ca. Good stuff. Good stuff over there. And I think Graham's going to read an excerpt from a new book, Unlearned. All right.
Did you send it or...?
I emailed it to you, so it should be in your email. And then you could share that with your kids, too. And so I have sent it out. I have sold some copies now. It's available. You can get it in any bookstore. I doubt the bookstore will have it. It'd be cool if they did, but I see no evidence that anyone has bought more than individual copies so far. But it's good. Some people, everyone who's read it so far has liked it. And said they wanted their kids to read it. So it's sort of my attempt to reach a broader audience and a younger audience. It's sort of that finding yourself stage. And so the reason we're doing that is because it's actually doing pretty well. Out of all the books we've done, this is one that's been doing the best. So we figure if a few other people go out and buy it or download it, it might push it up into the algo and maybe we could fucking finally make some money and help some people. This is the thing. Is the main thing is that everybody's doing this sort of self-help. There's a million different books to make you a better person and help you figure out how to figure out life. You know, we've talked about a ton of them on this show that I know I could never do a better job of writing. You know, you got books like Outwitting the Devil and these other ones that are fucking masterpieces. But there's nothing sort of aimed at that younger, you know, 15 to 25 or under 30 that doesn't really want to, you know, they see a book and it scares them off. So. I tried to sort of encapsulate that into, I think it's only about a 90-minute read. If you're power reading it, you could probably get through it in an hour. The chapters are like as long as it takes to take a shit, so you could sort of get through it that way. And it's very short and direct, so hopefully it can reach some kids and help some people out.
Yeah, that sounds good. You want me to read the intro then?
Wasting their 20s drinking and partying, because then it takes forever to sort of fucking... I mean, if I wouldn't have done that, I wouldn't be doing anything right now. I'd be on a boat someplace.
on a boat. Well, I mean, I kind of wasted my 20s drinking, but I also worked my way up the corporate ladder. I mean, I had a pretty successful life, but then I just couldn't stop. So that's the problem. I mean, you either waste your ambition, or you just can't get out of that vicious cycle.
And you got to make sure you use your ambition to go up the right ladder.
Exactly.
So you don't end up at the top of some.
Yeah. I was going down to my bottom. I didn't know at the time.
Ba-da-ba.
So you want me to read the introduction?
Sure.
All right. Introduction. This book isn't for everyone. It's not for people who want to stay numb, complain about the system, or keep blaming everyone else while their potential collects dust. It's for those who feel the tension, that itch in your gut that says, there's more to me than this. It's for the ones who know deep down that they were never taught how to actually live, only how to obey. School didn't prepare you for the real world. It trained you for a controlled one. It taught memorization instead of motivation, compliance instead of curiosity, fear of failure instead of power through practice. You might have been labeled lazy or average or unmotivated, but what if it wasn't you? What if you were just never taught how to win? Nothing is set in stone. Let me be clear. You can change your life at any age. There's no expiration date on discipline, purpose, or reinvention. You could be 15 or 50 or 55, like Graham. What matters is your decision to turn the wheel. But if you're reading this and you're young, start now. Because every year you wait, the habits get heavier. The lies get louder. The regret grows deeper. Starting early doesn't make the path easier. It makes it yours. You didn't fail the system. It failed you. This book isn't about whining. It's about reclaiming control. You'll learn the stuff that should have been taught in school. How your habits shape your identity. Why discipline isn't punishment, it's power. How to deal with pressure, addiction, failure, and indecision. How to build wealth, self-respect, and a name that means something. You'll learn how to stop drifting, how to choose your direction and become the kind of person who leads without waiting for permission. This book won't solve your problems. You will, but it will give you the tools and the map and the mindset. It's time to unlearn. Unlearn the fear, unlearn the self-doubt, unlearn the comfort trap they wrapped around your potential like a blanket. This is the blueprint you never get. This is the blueprint you never got. Read it, use it, then build something so real and undeniable no one can ever put you back in that box again. Welcome to Unlearned. Let's go.
Man, I should have had you read it.
That was good. That's a good start.
It's not bad. Read the Buffett quote too, and then we'll finish with that.
The chains of habit are too light to be felt until they are too heavy to be broken. I like that. Warren Buffett.
Yeah.
So yeah. I mean, this is good because it's kind of like a little self-help, but also got a little bit of, like motivation and it's okay to be competitive and adventurous and what's the word I'm looking for? Ambitious, right?
Yeah.
You know,
you should be, you need to be.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're going to get stuck in a fucking rut.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, no, part of it was is I didn't think I had any business writing anything like that until I didn't have a day job.
Right.
You know, how do you tell people how to get ahead when you're fucking still slaving away yourself?
Yeah. It's funny. I got a huge inspiration to write when I quit my job, too. And then I just didn't do anything with the book. You know, I kind of got those downloads and I got up in the middle of the night and I was writing it out. I should maybe revisit that again, you know, because it was kind of about addiction. Then it kind of turned into a program. Then I'm like, oh man, like, I don't think. And then I did a test meeting for the program and I was like, I don't, this is too, this, it felt too big, right? Like, this could be a recovery program. So my book turned into a program and then I got overwhelmed or maybe scared or whatever, right? And maybe, and then I was like, oh, I just got to rewrite it as an idea. Like, this is an idea of the program, but I should probably revisit that.
Might as well. It's got like a bunch of the work done already.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, I should probably do that today.
What do you got, like 70 pages or something? 80 pages?
Yeah, I think so. And maybe it's just like this, like just a small book. It doesn't have to be 200 pages.
No, I mean, a lot of this, the thing with the small book is it plays to a lot of media well, you know, it can be chopped up into little short chapters. I think the chapters are under 5 minutes, a lot of them. So those can be like, that's short enough to be played on in a TikTok, or eventually I'll get it out on a YouTube and it can be YouTube shorts and just like hopefully get out there. And if I can find an audience for this sort of thing, then it's something that I can do more of. I mean, it's because it's like that touching, it's sort of touching on some Napoleon Hill, it's touching on some Peterson, it's touching on some stuff that could be opened up in a little more in depth, but this is a good sort of icebreaker.
Yeah, it's good.
So I can get that.
Let's tease the chapters a bit too here. This while I'm here. So you've got. Let me just go back to the index or the contents. So wake up now. Your next 10 years, decide everything. The drift is real and it's coming for you. Hard work is the real flex. Alcohol, weed, and the slow death of potential. You are what you watch, scroll, and repeat. Be the hero, not a victim, not a clone. Energy, ethics, and the law of compounding. Failure is fuel, not a finish line. While no one's coming to save you, or why no one's coming to save you, your mind is a magnet, so point it right. The discipline loop, how habits build titans. Make money with integrity or get owned by the system. Vision is the weapon they forgot to give you. Ah, I like that. Legacy mode, why you start now or regret later. And then, oh yeah, there's micro habits that change your life in 90 days. Build the life you want. No one else will do it for you. And closing charge, the next 10 years are yours. Yeah, it's a good idea. I was talking to a young person who was like, well, if I didn't have to work, I wouldn't work. I would just not, you know, and I said, well, you're going to want to do something, right? Like let's say UBI, because UBI came up, right? And I said, well, what would you do? Like, you'd have to feel productive doing something, right? You would want to work around the house or do something, right? Because it is weird when you have a house, like I have a house now for the first time. I owned an apartment a long time ago, many lifetimes ago, but you know, having one and having all this work to do around the house, like it actually feels good. Like I was avoiding it when I lived in the city. I was like, I don't want to do the lawns. I want to just have like, you know, my, not the lawns, but as an example, right? Like the city is my backyard. Like I'm not participating in the homes type thing, right? But now this is totally different and it's fun and it feels productive and it's challenging and it's, you know, there's like little, what's the word I'm looking for? You know, little troubleshooting things. You always got to troubleshoot and repair stuff, but it does feel like you're productive, right? I mean, and whether you're fixing up the place or renovating it or just working around the house or, you know, what, there's so much to do. It's unbelievable. Like there's always so much to do, but if I wasn't doing this, I mean, that's the thing. Cause he says like, you know, I wouldn't work. And I'm like, well, I would probably read, even if I didn't have to, I would probably read still, you know? I might change the books I would read a little bit, you know? What were we going to say?
Well, and everything else, you know, we'd still probably want to travel anyway.
Yeah, we'd still probably want to podcast now and then, maybe not as much if we didn't have to, but, you know, like, or maybe more, you know, maybe more like maybe a different style or a different type. But the point is that you need to like hard work. There is a satisfaction to hard work.
Well, it's what people are meant to do. Up until very recently, not working was not an option. You just got up and worked all day and went to bed, which is sort of what I still try and do. I mean, I've factored in some shooting my bow and playing with my bow and doing stuff like that, which I still think of work. I mean, I'm shooting my bow now because I'm getting ready for hunting season. I got my cams out. You know, shit's getting real. The boys are coming over in a couple months.
Yeah.
I just seen a nice big bull moose today on my cam. Still young antlers too. I mean, he might have a nice big rack on him in another couple months. But one of my cams, I don't know what it was. It was an elk or a moose. Knocked the thing on the ground and then chewed on it. I mean, you've seen the video, right? I mean, if you turn the sound on in the video, you could hear he's like licking it or doing something. And then he comes back like 4 hours later and you can just see his leg because the camera's now down on the ground and like fucks with it a little more. And now my camera just like, it's shooting the ground. When the grass blows real lots, I'll get an update that it's just, I gotta drive another 2 hours out there, hike fucking 45 minutes into the bush.
That's pretty weird, eh? That out of all that area, you put this cam there and then the wildlife actually knows the cam.
You know what? It's because like, usually I'll put it on a tree, but there's this water hole there and there's no trees real close to it. And I was like, man, I'd like to get it right on that water, because you've seen the shots I was getting. They're phenomenal. Like there's a couple shots there where the deer is like literally probably about a foot away from the trail cam eating grass. And then but the thing is, so there was no tree there. So we like drug a stump over there that's got a thing on it. So it's like, if a human walked into that space, you would instantly be like, oh, look, there's a camera there. Whereas when it's tied to a tree, you kind of got to really be looking. You got to fucking, there's so many trees everywhere. You got to really notice it. But where I am, and I'm, you know, I trust Alberta hunters not to steal my shit. You know, I would never steal someone's trail cam. I might leave them a funky picture, but I wouldn't touch it. And especially nowadays, even if you were kind of a shady prick, it's like if someone takes my camera, it's GPS'd. It's like locked to my app to me. I'm sure there's some way to wipe that thing or reset it to factory defaults, but it's just a risky endeavor, you know?
Yeah.
Like someone might literally show up at your house when you get home with the camera.
So can you have a Sasquatch cam going? Why aren't you?
Well, I mean, they're there. If there's a Sasquatch out there, it should catch it.
And it's going to turn that on automatically, unless it's kind of half disappearing or half in and out.
Motion. So, I mean, maybe it was Sasquatch that fucked the camera.
I know, maybe, eh? Did you see, did you get a view of him coming up to it, or was it just a big blob? Was it a blob squatch that licked it? I mean, maybe it was
Sasquatch. He came at it from the side, and by the time the camera picked it up, I'm curious to see, to get the SD card out of it, to see if it has anything extra on it. But and the camera's still covered in morning dew because it happened at 5:53 a.m. So did you not watch the video?
Yeah, I saw part of it, I think, because it was all fuzzy.
So the dew's still on the camera from the morning when it comes up to it. So it's this like fuzzy, blurry image. But you can sort of see it's a face. I think it's a moose face. And you can see the outline of its head, sort of. So it's definitely some sort of an ungulate. I mean, it's fucking knocked my camera over. I can't believe it. So I got to go. It's a huge effort. This is a huge undertaking to go and like to go put those cameras up was a whole day's work. Now it's got to go back. I'm going to bring my bow with me, though, because I'm almost out of meat, so in case the crust slips sooner than later, I'd like to get at least something in the freezer. I'm holding off a lot of my hunting until the boys get here, because we got that 10 days of hunting from September 25th to October 4th. We're going to be in the mountains for a couple days and in the plains at the lake for a couple days. And all
still
of
have room?
Still have room if you want to get tickets. They can get tickets for that. There's a link in the show notes, I think, right?
Yep, there's always a link in the show notes for that, yeah.
Yeah, so people can check that out. There's still a couple spots left. Tony be coming over. Donnie's coming. It's going to be a good time. Oliver's talking about coming up for that. So we'll be a lot of camping, a lot of like backcountry, having a time. You know, I'm going to have the boat out. We'll probably maybe even if like, because during the day we duck hunt in the morning and we might do a little fishing, see if we can catch some fish to eat. But, you know, we're definitely going to take down some animals. Well, you're going to see me take down some animals. If you get in early enough, there's an opportunity. You could try and bow a deer or even maybe rifle a deer if you could get that. I think you can get a whitetail pretty easily. You just got to pony up the dough, a couple $100. And
that's for a ticket.
That'd be for a tag. The ticket. Yeah. But the duck tags, I mean, we're going to be shooting a bunch of ducks. So that's like the highlight of the trip is we're going to be doing ducks and geese.
So, how is that a highlight? I mean, people might like to go after the big stuff. I mean, it's good variety of stuff you got going on there.
Yeah, well, dude, once you've been duck hunting, you understand why that's a highlight. I mean, when 10,000 geese are landing on you and you just jump up and start blasting and then lie down and then wait and then do it again. And then, you know, that's pretty hard to, it's really pretty hard to top. you would check it out. I mean, I recommend it. There's like, not a lot of spots. It's a very small and intimate event. There's only going to be a handful of us out there doing it. So it's going to be a very backwoods, very camping and very rugged. It's going to be fun. So right up my alley.
Yeah, that's good.
And Tony the Tiger will be there. So, I mean, you should come out.
I will. I was just thinking that I'll probably come out just to, you know, drop some Tim Hortons donuts off for you guys or something and some coffee and
come and find us in the woods.
Yeah. Come and find you in the woods. Maybe throw up a tent overnight or something. But probably won't be able to come for longer than that.
I might go fix the camera this weekend. We'll see. It's been raining a lot. So the truck's running good. So that's good.
That's good. Yeah. It's been like 14 degrees here during the day. Like it's been cold, but it's actually been good to work outside in that. It's been perfect temperature to work in. Just in a t-shirt without being cold or hot. Perfect temperature in a way to be lifting 80 pound pavers.
And everything's growing like crazy.
Yeah.
It's really growing like crazy. It's something else.
So yeah. Did I tell you about the pavers?
The old pavers from under the shed?
Yeah. On the show? I don't think I talked about on the show, did I?
Not on the show.
So I was looking at I was going to put the new sheds on these old pavers, and I thought, well, I could use railway tie. They sell these ties at the hardware store, a 4x4 tie to put the shed on, right? So I thought, well, I could just use these pavers because we had all these old, we had 12 unbroken pavers, right? And I thought, because we need to make a path that's shovelable from the house to the garage, because there wasn't really a path. It was just on the grass, and it was, so I thought we could do these pavers. So I measure it all out. I dig the trench in the grass and I'm putting the pavers down. I actually bought some crusher dust, which is those angular rocks and sand mix to level it out and to pat it down. And so to try to get the right elevation for all the pavers, because I was putting them together, no gap between them, right? I want them exactly flat as possible so you can shovel it in the winter properly. So it's easy for, you know, Maria to shovel it, right? For me. But so I started doing it like five in, and then I noticed, because they're all that old style concrete paver, you know, 2 feet by 30 inches. Like they're heavy, like 80. I think they're 80 pounds each. I heard somebody say they feel like they're about 80 pounds each. So anyways, I got four or five down, and then I'm about to put the other one down. My buddy Frank's helped me, and I look and I go, this is not the same one. This is different. And we look, sure enough, a little higher in height. It's got a slightly different like chamfer on the edge. I'm like, oh. So I was looking at, I was planning on, if we didn't have enough full ones, I would dig up the ones from the front lawn that have been grown over, like, you know, grown over. They look like they're, you know, 3 inches less on each side because it's grown over so much, but it looks like it's designed, like it doesn't look bad. It's just the pavers are just hardly there anymore, right? Or half there. So I pull one of those out. And then so it's different as well. So I think this is exactly the same paver as the ones we started to use, right? The ones I thought I had like 12 of. And I'm like, that's got a different chamfer. It's different. That's a different height. So we had like three different types of pavers, three or four. And they're all these tip. I was thinking, well, these are the same typical ancient paver that they made way back when, right, out of concrete or whatever, these concrete pavers. So then I was like, so I started digging them up from the front and just created this. There was like one slight transition from one style to the next. And then we finished it off. And then I'm going to buy new ones for the front and redo the front where I pulled those other ones out. So it's been good. So I got the whole thing done. Now I got to just cut a couple corner pieces for the end.
What's a paver go for these days?
They're not much, like 17, 18 bucks or something for the smaller. I bought the smaller ones, the 2x2 ones. Actually it was $420 for, 420 divided by 18, $23.
$23 a paver?
Yeah.
That's not too bad. GrandAmerica.ca/support.
But now I got to buy, now I got to recycle all these old ones. Like, cause I didn't want to throw them away. I was like, I got to recycle these, right? I don't want to deal with these big, heavy pavers. Cause you know, like everything, you know how much all the dump runs have cost me? And they don't want to take rental stuff, right? So you got to drive it way past the normal dump and give it and pay somebody else to take it. So it's super frustrating when you're trying to actually just clean up and throw stuff away. You have to pay through the nose for it. So I might be able to get the concrete guy to recycle these pavers. I think they can grind them back up and sell them.
My dump is free.
Nice.
Yeah.
Even with even if you have like 1,000 pounds of old broken pavers.
If I had 1,000 pounds of broken pavers, they might start asking some questions. I mean, there's got to be some place to just dump.
They'll take them, and the concrete place will take them. The guy, there's a local guy here that gave me the crusher dust, or that sold me the crusher dust, and he's like, "Oh yeah, I'll come by with the bucket, and you can throw them in, and I'll take them to the concrete guy." Like, super helpful.
Just
small town guy. The guy that what?
Do you have to pay to have them recycled?
No, I don't. I mean, if they're gonna crush them up and use them, then they should be paying me for them, right?
I can guarantee you they're not paying you for them. I'll bet money on that.
So we'll see. I'll keep you up to date. But now I do have to get rid of a bunch of them because I'm going to replace the front. I'm going to replace the front yard ones. Instead of putting broken ones back in the front yards, I'm going to just do the 2x2 all the way up to the house in the front.
Beauty.
Wow. But the trench is already there, so I don't have to dig that. And I have a whole bunch of leftover crusher dust, so I'll just, you know, level that one out too, and then...
What about the bath?
Well, just waiting on the flooring now.
Waiting for it to arrive?
Yeah. Uh-oh. It should be here probably this week, I think.
No end in sight.
And then get the flooring done, so then the bath's done. Once that part, then I can sort of take my time a little bit on the inside. I just want to get the bath ready.
I need another shed now, too.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, the stuff just piles up. I just need a shop. I need a little shop.
Oh yeah, totally. Like, I mean, that's why I understand why guys like want the tools in the shop, right? I'm like, oh my God, I need to clean out the garage to have room for the tools and figure out where everything's at.
If we were still in that office, we would have that bay rented by now.
Oh yeah, 100%. 100%. I would love to have a big
bay like that.
Working. Fixing stuff,
park some stuff. I could put my boat there, you know.
Yeah,
I had it parked. I had the plug in it when it rained. So, I mean, I really think, but if you don't catch it in time, it'll probably collapse the trailer and everything. That's a fucking lot of water.
What? What are you talking about? The what?
The boat fills up with water when it rains if I don't pull the plug out. Something you don't think of, mm-hmm. And then it weighs like fucking 10,000 pounds. That much, but it's a lot of fucking water.
Yeah,
it probably is pretty close to 10,000 pounds because I think my fish tank is supposed to be supposedly like 1,100, and you would fit fucking several of my fish tanks into the boat.
Yeah,
and then my little trailer would just collapse under its own weight. So that'd be a problem. Anyway, support the show. GrandAmerica.ca/support. We just keep trudging along over here, you know, doing the show, doing it all, trying to bring some value to wherever you're listening. Maybe it's your commute or while you're at work, while you're working out. And if we are able to add some value there, maybe head over to GrandAmerica.ca/support today and sign up for a monthly or make a one-time donation. That would be pretty cool. We would be happy with that, and it would help us keep doing the show without ever thinking about having to quit. And I don't think that we have any new supporters this week.
I have an email.
Did we do Rachel Flynn already?
No, I don't think so.
We do have Rachel Flynn to thank. That's $50 US. I thought we did that, though.
Yeah, maybe. Well, I have one. I have a note from Matt. He says, I wanted to send a belated birthday shout out to the world's favorite podcaster, Graham Dunlop, a 55.49 donation for the big 55, along with 11.11 monthly, brings the total to 66.6 with the big.
Who's that from?
Matt. Should be enough to pay for some carbon credits to your net zero emperor to offset some of your traveling or to stock up on some Red Bull. I finally got to meet you guys at the CAC last September and had an absolute blast. It was great getting to have casual chats with Randall and Brad, doing a beer run with Darren and hanging out with Graham as we hiked down a mountain. It's something I definitely recommend to my buddies and can't wait to do another one as time at work and the wife allows. So thanks, Matt. Thanks for the Red Bull.
Thanks for the Red Bulls. There you have it. Thanks, guys. Send some support, and we will read your note on the show, and we will be extremely grateful. This is all we got is you guys to help us get through life. So it'd be helpful. GrandAmerica.ca/support. Check out the audiobooks at adultbrain.ca, a-list.ca for Canadian bullcrap. And we'll contact at thecabin.com for trips and events. We got some great ones coming out. We're planning the crop circle making CAC. And that was like, it's going to be a fun time. And of course, there's some
spots. You said it out loud?
So what out loud? We're not supposed to say that out loud yet?
Well, I don't
know. We're not doing that.
We're not quite there yet.
Scratch that.
These are the ideas we have. No, I mean, we could, maybe we can sell it.
We had a meeting. It's in proper development.
It's in total development.
In development. So we have that. We have Easter Island. We have the Azores. We have a bunch of fantastic stuff there. Check all that stuff out. Contact at thecabin.com. Grab that book if you can. Tell your friends to grab that book. Grab it for some people you like. Unlearned. Why school failed you and what to do about it. And what else? That's it. That's it. Enjoy the chat with Sue Terry.
Terry, welcome back to Gray America. How are you?
I'm good, Graham. Thanks so much for having me on. Hey, Darren.
Hello.
Yeah, you're welcome. It was great that you reached out. Read your book. It's just sitting on my bookshelf in the back there. Awesome. I thought it. Yeah, this sounds kind of interesting and definitely interesting. Hermetic principles in music. The seven hermetic principles in music. So yeah, we're looking forward to chatting about that. How have you been since the last time we had you on?
Yeah, I've been well, busy, you know, writing a lot and playing a lot. As you know, I live in Ecuador, so there's a lot going on here. It's like the summer season, but I think you guys are having a heat wave, right? We're freezing over here.
No, we're not having a heat wave. I mean, not where I am. I'm in the middle of the prairies in Canada, and it's been pretty ugly summer so far. Lots of rain and clouds. We haven't really got like summer heat yet. I mean, Darren's a little bit further west, so he might have a little bit more heat. But I mean, so many people are interested in Ecuador these days. How is that going down there?
Oh, it's a great country. I've been living here off and on since 2010, and I really, really like it. I married an Ecuadorian man, a wonderful writer, and we live in the country with a bunch of pets. So we're pretty happy here.
That's awesome. Good for you. Yeah. I'm in the country now myself too. So yeah. So what, of all the books you've been writing and all, what made you go into this, into, you know, tying in the hermetic wisdom with the music?
Well, I this is an idea that I woke up with one day, you know? And so like thinking about, cause I do a lot of teaching. So I have to think about the best ways to communicate my ideas to my students. And in fact, I dedicated the book to my students. And basically, I just think that the world is so full of mystery, and music is even more so full of mystery, right? So like, what's the most organic driver of learning about these mysteries? And it's curiosity. Whereas in music, you see a lot of people, they're driven by this desire for mastery, right? But actually, curiosity is a better state to be in, about musical ideas and concepts and techniques, or anything that you want to learn about, because it's a more innocent and childlike state. So it invites learning in a natural way. So that was the motivation behind the book, because I have all these books about hermetic philosophy in my library. And one day I just woke up with this idea, hey, you can apply all of the hermetic principles to music. In fact, two of the principles, vibration and rhythm, are actual musical terms that we use all the time, right? So the whole, all of the principles are, the first one is mentalism, but you can also say all is mind, right? And we can go into that more. Correspondence, vibration, polarity, rhythm, cause and effect, and gender. So I had this idea to apply all of them. How would they relate if you're talking about music, performing music, playing music, learning about music, and deepening your relationship with music? That was the motivation behind the book.
Yeah, it seemed pretty deep to me, because a lot of it, like, I'm not well-versed in the musical theory or anything like that. So a lot, some of it was over my head, like when you're talking about the techniques of music and all that, but it was still fascinating to read. What was I going to say about that? The music, I like, well, we're curiosity seekers here. So that definitely fits in with us being curious about stuff, you know, that feel like the more we learn, the less we know. And what were some of the drivers, like, for people that aren't sure what their hermetic laws are? Can you explain those briefly?
Yeah, so the first principle is called mentalism. Well, first of all, let's go back to the book that inspired everybody. It's called The Kybalion.
Yeah.
And I think, like, all of us who are into kind of spiritual philosophy have come across The Kybalion kind of early on, because it's a compendium of the hermetic principles. And if you're really a diehard ironclad hermeticist, you're going to go with other texts that are older than that, you know, the Emerald Tablets and the Corpus Hermeticum and all that. But The Kybalion, what it did, it's kind of part of a new thought movement that arose in the early part of the last century. So it kind of popularized these principles. So all is mind, mentalism. That basically means that whatever is manifesting in the earth, or that we can see, that we can hear, that we perceive with the senses, it starts in not only the mind of us, but also in universal mind. So it has this idea of speaking of a higher power in terms of a universal mind. The principle of correspondence, people know it as above, so below. And if you finish that up, it's as below, so above. So it's all of that. The principle of vibration, that everything vibrates. And science has been talking about that since Einstein, right? Polarity. It talks about polarity, meaning that there aren't really direct opposites. You know, what are the opposites that we talk about, like day and night, or male, female, or black and white? It talks about a spectrum instead of these opposites that are in conflict. It talks about the idea that one can turn into the other depending on where it moves on the spectrum. Principle of rhythm, which has to do with entrainment and kind of locking in, phase locking into this guiding pulse. Cause and effect, which we know all about that. And I reference Newton, Isaac Newton, in the book, because a lot of times people think of cause and effect as a linear thing. Like, first you have a cause, then you have an effect. But it's actually not that. They're together. So if you look at how Isaac Newton described cause and effect. Like if you push against the ground, you push against the ground to go up. Like if you're in a race or something, you push off against the ground, but it's the pushing against the ground that makes you lift at the same time. So that's what that's about. And then the principle of gender, which is super interesting today because there's a lot of fluidity in that idea today socially, you know, but the principle of gender goes back to the gender archetypes of male, female, from which all creation arises. Did I summarize that okay?
Yeah. But I mean, I also want to talk about how old this is because it does, it seems to stand the test of time pretty good. I mean, this is going back now, what, over 2000 years, like 20, it goes back to Hermes, right? Supposedly.
Graham, you're breaking up, so I don't hear you that well.
Yeah. Can you hear me now? How's that? Okay. I wonder if that's my internet or hers. Can you hear me now?
Now this is better.
Yeah. Well, I was saying that it stands the test of time, these principles. Like, I'd like to talk about how old they are. They go back, what, 2,000, 2,300 years, supposedly, to Hermes, or how old do they go? How old is it?
Yeah. I mean, you can trace this back all the way to like Alexandria in Egypt, you know. And the interesting thing about Hermes Trismegistus, which is the philosopher who this is all based on, is that he was actually kind of a compendium of different philosophers of the day, like a mixture of, or even gods of the day. So a mixture of the god Hermes and the god Thoth. And what people used to do in the old days is they didn't want to take credit, like the Bible, they didn't really want to take credit for the teachings. And so they would attribute the teachings to this kind of mythological, legendary, representational figure. And so this Hermes Trismegistus, which means Hermes thrice great. So the teachings were attributed to him, even though they were a compendium of all of these philosophical ideas of the time that were grouped under this Hermetic label.
So those seven principles you mentioned there, when we talk about those musically, are we just sort of transferring those over? Because there's seven, do, re, mi, fa, sol, la. T is seven as well. Is that sort of scale? Is that the seven? Is that the seven that goes over to the principles?
Well, you could mix that in and you could relate that to it as well, but it goes a lot deeper than that. That's just, you know, there, I think the idea of there being seven principles and also seven musical tones in a major scale, that I don't want to say that's a coincidence, because the number seven is kind of a mystical number, and that's why we see it all the time in these things. But
and seven chakras.
Yeah, exactly. But when I go into detail about how each principle relates to specific things in music, that when you're a musician, you study these things. And also when you're a listener, you know, you listen for these things as well. So I have like different stories in the book, like for cause and effect. I tell a story that I heard personally from Philip Glass. And he's one of the most famous minimalist composers, right? And he said that when people have a mistaken idea about minimalism, because a lot of people trash minimalism. You know, they say it's boring or they say it's repetitive. And he says, actually, there is no repetition, because if you have a note and then you repeat that note and then you repeat that same note, every time you repeat the note, it's been affected by the fact that you had the note before it. And that was affected by the note before that. And so there's a lot of influence as time unfolds, it creates effects that couldn't have existed without that unfolding, if that makes any sense. So he was like, there actually is nothing that really repeats, because everything was affected by what came before it.
So minimalism is like playing everything on the same note type thing?
Well, it's not, it's kind of like when anything that you look at has two aspects, right? You have an exterior kind of superficial aspect, and then you have a more interior, more philosophical, deeper aspect. And so when the music of when minimalist music is playing, you can listen to it and you can be like, oh, that's just like repetition all the time. But then if you really listen to it, then you enter more deeply into it and you stay with how it's changing, because it's changing in very subtle ways every moment. So it's a lot different than pop music or even jazz, you know, or rock or some of the other types of music that we're listening to. But if you enter inside of it, it's like surfing, right? If you're watching people surfing, that's a lot different than actually surfing, because when you're surfing, you have to feel the water and feel the waves and feel how everything is moving. And if you don't do that, you ain't going to be surfing. You're going to be falling in the water, right? So it's these different ways of listening to music and approaching music.
Darren, do you have any more questions on that at all?
It does seem like it can't be a coincidence. I swear we talked to someone before that was talking about the chakras having something to do with that scale, the musical scale as well, but I can't quite put my finger on what the...
Well, they're supposed to correspond with those. There's supposed to be a sound
like that corresponds. A different ohm is supposed to help each one, right? Whatever, however that works. So.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people are doing frequency healing now where they... But this is not a new thing, you know. That's Royal Rife
too, right? The tuning forks, I think, come in a set of seven too, right?
Yeah, but the biofield tuning, totally. Yeah, everything, you know, because everything is frequency. So that goes back to vibration, the principle of vibration. Everything is frequency. Everything is vibrating. Everything has a corresponding tone, an actual musical tone or an actual frequency that may be inaudible, but it's still a frequency. Just like light, like we don't hear light and we don't hear colors, but we see them because the frequency is higher than what we can perceive with the ear.
Have you done any sort of cymatic testing with that? I mean, you were talking about how that form of music is different from pop or different from this or different from that. I'd be interested in how they display differently cymatically.
Cymatically, I think cymatics is used more with individual tones, individual frequencies, than it is with an actual genre of music. Like if you put on, you know, Led Zeppelin, would you get a cymatic?
I suppose you would. You just would have to slow it down enough so that you could take it each out in turn, so that you could sort of translate it. If you just do it all at once, I don't think you could do it. You'd have to sort of go through the hymns or the songs or the whatever they are, kind of tone by tone, to get some sort of weird. I mean, then you'd have these weird symbols that are almost like a language.
Yeah, I think you could do it, but I don't know if people have done that. I know that they've done it with individual frequencies, but in terms of extracting individual frequencies from a larger picture, I don't know about that.
I wonder if we could find some like hidden language inside some of these, because I can't think of any off the top of my head, but we must have certain like melodies or just sort of rhythms that have been around forever, you know, that's sort of the same. I don't know, but I guess originally they would have been chants or whatever they would have been originally, but it just seems like, I wonder if there's a language there that could be unpacked. Because we had a guy on a few months ago that was saying he was doing the ohms with the whatever stretched over the sarcophagus in the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramids to make that into a cymatic thing. And they were doing the ohms, and he says they were getting Egyptian hieroglyphs.
They were getting hieroglyphs in the cymatic
of the Egyptian gods. How many Egyptian gods are there? Is there seven? That'd be crazy, right?
Depends on what time frame it. You know.
That's pretty wild. Well, you know, I think all of these things are in the collective unconscious. You know, one time I was doing an ayahuasca ceremony in Peru, and I went outside, and I was looking at the ground, and there were all these symbols of the Inca symbols of you know, the types of motifs that you see all over in Peru and in Ecuador. I was seeing them in the ground, like embedded in the ground, like the Australian song lines that the Aborigines see when they're walking in the outback. So I think these symbols are there. They're there for us to access however we can access them.
You mentioned healing going way back, like musical healing going way back. Is that something that goes back to the healing temples, that kind of stuff? The also before that, maybe?
Yeah, I think so. The idea of healing with sounds, that's pretty ancient. I mean, if you just think of a mother holding a baby and singing to the baby and making the soft sounds to comfort the baby, I mean, that is a type of sound healing. So it's a very natural kind of human instinctive way to apply healing. And in a more scientific way, there's people like Royal Rife who actually plotted out the frequencies of parasites and diseases. And then he plotted out what frequencies you could use to kind of nullify those other the bad frequencies. So he was like using the good frequencies to nullify the bad frequencies.
And then he was nullified.
Yes, exactly. Like Wilhelm Reich, you know, these people who had these very advanced ideas that were so worthy of research and exploration, and instead people just nailed them to the cross.
Yeah, it's crazy. It made me think, reading your book made me think of how old some of this, like, it's hard to imagine how old music is, like how that, like thousands of years ago they were playing it and it was a big part of society. And I often think of the bards traveling around, like using music as a tool for communication before there was internet or any kind of, because how were people like in the middle of nowhere finding out about things, right? They go to the nearest town and probably, you know, hear the bard come by and tell stories fantastically with music. But it reminded me of this quote from one of these songs I heard in the 1990, I think it was from 1990. So 35 years ago, from Pop Will Eat Itself. And it has these quotes from a preacher. So it's a preacher talking about music and he says, Plato, when the music of a society changes, the whole society will change. And then Aristotle says, when music changes, there should be laws to govern the nature and the character of that music. And then Lenin says, the best and quickest way to undermine any society is through its music. So I just, you know.
And hey, this is a caveat. I think one of the cruise lines just banned hip hop.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I can't remember, but one of the major cruise lines just said that it's not banned, but they're leaning out of it.
As far as music that they were going to play on the entertainment boat, on the ship?
Yeah, entertainment on the ship, because they found that when the more hip hop they do, the more trouble they have, which just going by, without digging into any weeds, just going by the music thing, that makes total sense, right? When you consider listening to, like, say, some classical or some Dwight Yoakam or some gangster rap that is, you know, a lot of violence is sort of, what's the word, you know, romanticized in hip hop.
Right. Like, you don't even need cymatics to know that.
No, you just need ears. I don't think, ears are still, you can just listen to it and see how that could, you get a bunch of people drinking and all jacked up, and then they could, you know, be wanting to just, it's the way it goes. That's why when you go to a concert that's playing a bunch of crazy heavy metal, there ends up being a mosh pit in the middle where everyone's just beating the shit out of each other and seemingly having fun doing it. I mean, it's not my thing, but.
Yeah, there's no question that music has that kind of power. And it can be power that's exercised in any direction, right?
I doubt that any of Bach stuff or Mozart stuff ever erupted into a mosh pit down at the center of the...
No, but Stravinsky's music did cause a riot.
Tell us about that.
Yeah.
When he wrote The Rite of Spring, which was a ballet, and the beginning of Rite of Spring, it has this kind of Jaws like theme, like dun 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 dun, and people were offended by it. They were frightened by it, and they were offended by it because no one had done that before. That wasn't the normal type of music that people were used to hearing. And there was actually a riot in the theater, and it shut down the whole performance.
When was that?
So 18, whatever, when it was debuted. Yeah. I don't have the exact date.
What would have done if we put Cardi B out? You know, if we could like somehow transplant her back down back to 1850 and just throw her on stage, I mean, they'd burn the fucking place down. Cardi B.
Who's that?
Some rapper whose number one song is called "Wet Ass Pussy."
I am not ashamed to say that I'm not familiar with it.
I got a bunch of kids, so. I'm introduced to things I'd rather not be introduced to.
But it's hard to believe they were talking about this 2,500 years ago. That's what I can't wrap my head around. So what were they playing back then?
Well, if you go back to the beginnings of music, then you have to talk about where there was civilization, right? So the first civilizations, let's say in Africa, their music was centered around rhythm. And still today, if you trace back all the African music, it all goes back to that really strong rhythmic basis. Whereas if, you know, the European cultures develop much later, and so their music doesn't revolve around rhythm. It revolves more around melody and harmony, you know. And then if you start talking about Asian civilizations, and now you start talking about different tuning systems, where Asian and Middle Eastern countries, where the tuning systems are totally different than what we use in the West. And I've been really fascinated lately with listening to Carnatic music, South Indian music, because their feeling of rhythm, you know, they have rhythms that are like, I mean, well, what are our common rhythms? You know, 3-4, 4-4, 12-8, 2-4, like very simple rhythms. But they're talking about 15, 10 and a half, 17, and I'm trying to understand how they feel that kind of a pulse, because I've tried to play Indian music. It's really difficult. You have to really steep yourself in, and it's a totally different feeling. Like I was talking about surfing before, you have to get inside it, and you have to just feel the pulse, because you can't count that.
That's one of the things I loved about your book, talking about how the musicians go with the flow or try to go with the flow, or how you got to go in there with, you can't just create, you have to be part of it. Like you have to kind of be part of it, it seemed like.
Yeah, exactly. And that's another reason that I wrote the book, is that I want the musicians to be able to bring more to the table when they're performing and when they're recording, because otherwise we're just going to be the same as AI. and that's already a big problem. You have platforms like Spotify that are actually making up fake artists so that they don't have to pay real artists. And they're just copying the music that the real artists have made and putting it through AI programs and calling it something else. And then they don't have to pay anything. You know, they make all the money.
Wow, they're doing that already?
People still have to listen.
They're already doing that.
Do you think it's going to resonate with people?
I think people listen to music for different reasons. And I think for some people that type of background music will be totally fine. That'll, you know, it's like if you just want a Big Mac and fries, yeah, then that's good. But if you're looking for, you know, filet mignon or sushi, you got to go elsewhere.
And go ahead, Darren.
Tough one. I mean, I kind of wonder, so how much do you think, because now we've kind of got this weird thing with the commoditization of music where it's like, you mentioned co-creating, which I don't feel like goes on anymore. Like, I wonder how much different would the music scene be if people went to a concert and they didn't know what they were going to hear from the band, because the band was going to spend, you know, half the time or a third of the time fucking around and just sort of making music with the rhythm of the crowd. And you've got all these people in one spot, and how that compares to where now it's more like you go to a concert to hear their 10 best songs or whatever it is, or hear the hits. They got to play the hits. I mean, some of these guys must be so sick of playing the hits. It's crazy.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Darren, because a lot of things now, not just music, a lot of things in our lives now are very regimented. And, you know exactly what you're going to get when you show up, or you know, presumably, you know what you're going to get. And I personally agree with that idea. And this is why I'm an improviser, why I'm a jazz musician, because I really like that idea of having the unexpected element. And I talk about that in the book, because when you are improvising, what you're doing is you're taking something that's unknown and you're bringing it into the realm of the known, right? And I make this comparison with, you know, how Graham Hancock goes to these places like Göbekli Tepe, and like no one ever heard of it. And then he discovers all these ruins and he writes a book about it and does a TV show. And then now everybody knows about it again. But it had retreated into the unknown until someone came and said, oh, wait a minute, let's talk about this. And that's what we do in improvisation all the time. We take unknown things and we bring them into the known, which I think is a really cool element of music and music performance.
And each time it's going to be a bit different, right? Who the sound of the place, the audience, the energy.
Yeah, totally. And that's another good point, Graham, that the audience also influences how the music is going to be played. Sometimes we even change the program based on the vibe that we get from the audience. I know some musicians that they don't even make a set list. They just go and show up and get the vibe of the audience, and then they decide what they're going to play.
Where is this new music? Where is it heading? Everything is changing so much with Spotify and YouTube. Like, I notice now, people get in trouble for playing people's music on YouTube. So now they get around it by doing these reaction videos. And actually, I really like some of the reaction videos of hearing some of our today's youth going back to the 80s and listening to some of the awesome stuff that we got to listen to. But where is it at for the artists, and where do you see it going at all? It must be changing sort of all the time, right? With Spotify and YouTube and the ability to produce your own music a bit better. Like, we have friends that produce their own album from scratch, like very professionally done, amazing. They did it value for value. They put it out for donation based, like for free, basically. They put their soundtrack, or this, whatever you call the instrumental in the background, out for people to use whenever they want. And it seemed to be a much better avenue than them going with a producer or a label.
Well, you know, we still have the same problem that we've always had, and that is how to reach the audience. And in a way, with every day, that problem gets worse because there's more people and there's more stuff taking people's attention. So you might think that being able to make your own albums now and publish your own books and this kind of thing, that in a way it's, yes, it's empowering because you don't have to go through the traditional gatekeepers of record labels and publishers. But then at the same time, it's, there's a glut, and to make your way through to get the attention of the public, you know, the big publishers and the big record labels, they have staff to do that. They have people, they have money, they have resources to buy the advertising, to put on performances and book readings and launches and things like that. So the independent artist,
do you think that's an improvement or not?
Well, I think that the independent artist has to cultivate those same type of resources. Otherwise, you're going to be spending all your time marketing and promoting and less time making your art.
Is that, is that a more navigable path than, say, 50 years ago, where you just had to, you had to entertain the right fellas, and if they wanted you, you were good, and if they didn't, you weren't, sort of thing? Is this, it's a little muddier now. I think it'll sort of start to clear up as some of us independents start to use some of these other tools that are coming to play. Like you talked about, AI might make shitty music, but I bet you it can help you come up with a promotion plan pretty effectively. So it's like it seems to me like, although it's getting a little more crowded in the space, that a lot more people have access to the space, and it's still just sort of working out how that new mechanism is going to work. Because it's like this, I mean, it would be fine if we just had social media that worked, you know, it just worked like, hey, lots of people like this stuff, so we're going to show it to more people, instead of having people in the back room, like, you know, the music industry is all over YouTube saying, no, you're going to show our shit and we're going to give you this much money to make sure that our guys show up in the play next. But I feel like there, for a while there, we were almost on it, like in the heyday of YouTube and stuff, where it was showing our stuff right next to, you know, history channels. It was very much dependent on what you were watching, and that was all that really mattered. And I feel like in that model, the cream is going to rise to the top, and it at least has the possibility to socialize the space more than it has been, but not like, maybe socialize is a bad word, because it was closer to socialism before, where you just had a group of powerful people that decided who got what. But, you know, almost more like a real socialism, a grassroots sort of socialism, where it's like anyone can make, I mean, in some ways, it's what podcasting still is. It's sort of spinning away from that now, where it's sort of going, you've got shows that are going mainstream, and you got guys that, you know, Joe Rogan and some of these guys have blown right out of the water, and you can almost see where they're trying to cultivate that a little bit, right? Like we were just talking about the show about the Epstein list, which we're not going to get into here, but it was like, we were just talking about how suddenly there's no list, but there was this weird thing where they did this thing like 6 months ago or 5 months ago, where they were giving like all these influencers, podcasters, like little secret tidbits of this investigation. Like they're trying to almost bring up a new mainstream within the alternative. But I guess podcasting would be the one where over the last decade, where it's about 15 years old, and up until the last few years, at least, it seems like it has really been there's a shitload of noise out there, but if you're good at it and you want it bad enough and you just keep improving and keep at it, then you can sort of get to the point where you can build maybe not a million people in the audience, but enough of an audience to eke out a living. Music can't get there too, you know, to the point where, because a musician doesn't need a million people listening, but if they could have, you know, a few thousand real dedicated listeners, that's all, maybe that's all that it needs. Maybe that's where music belongs more than like one song for 100 million people.
I think it was easier for the cream to rise to the top in previous eras than it is now. I think now you really need a team, because in order to cut through and publicize a new social media, you have to have people that are dedicated to doing that. And when the artist themselves is out there all by themselves trying to do everything, that's really, really, really hard. You know, in the old days, you had your agent and your manager and your label and your publisher or whatever you businesses were behind you, and you were focused on making your art. But now, you just have to take whatever those resources were that are being used by large companies. You have to have a similar access to resources like that, and that includes money too.
Yeah, you have to upload it to 10 different platforms now, and instead of somebody just handling all that, if you're handling it yourself, you got to do all this kind of uploading and marketing and follow-up and administration and all that stuff yourself.
The difference is that I can just do it. I don't need some dude in a funny hat to tell me it's okay to do it. And I might make it and I might not, but I can just go to those platforms. I can upload it. I have the choice at least to pursue that. Whereas before, I had one point of entry or two points of entry. And if they said no, that was it. You were kind of screwed, I think. I mean, I wasn't around back then, and I'm not a practicing musician. I'm a hobby musician. But even when I was younger and we were practicing musicians and we were trying to make bands and we were trying to do this, we were trying to do that, it was like, we didn't even have a YouTube, you know, we couldn't, there was a couple people in our shitty little town that you might be able to get to come out and get drunk and see you. And, you know, other than that, it was like, I think back in those days, you were trying to get a tape. You're trying to make a tape to get it to somebody. You needed to get a tape into somebody's hand so that maybe, but I mean, in the middle of nowhere, Northwestern Ontario, this is, you know, almost no chance that's going to happen. And then, I mean, I guess over the last few years, we've seen a couple of these sort of internet guys take it to that next level. I don't know a bunch of them. I can think of the one guy that just had the Richmond song, Richmond. And then before that, there's Zach Bryan, who's kind of a household name now, but he started out on YouTube reading poetry, that guy, and got a big following doing that and started turning into music. And now the dude's, you know, this big country star. But those are just sort of a couple examples. And there's a fella over by me here, Coulter Wall in Saskatchewan, that does a bunch of old country western music that just sort of did it himself. Now, he got lucky and got Tom Green and Joe Rogan to give him a shout out. So he ended up getting a bunch of audience that way. But he's just a good old boy who owns a ranch, refuses to go on the Joe Rogan podcast because it interferes with his ranch and his music life. And he's able to just, you know, I don't know how much money the guy's making, but he just does it the way he wants to do it. And it seems to have percolated through. Now, Coulter seems to be the real good example of it, because like I say, the dude won't even do interviews. He's like, nah, man, I'm on my farm. I'm making music because it's fun for me. People seem to like it, so it's enough to help out with my lifestyle a little bit. But he doesn't, you know, it's just sort of, whereas I don't think you could have got a Coulter Wall 50 years ago. Because if he doesn't want to be famous, then it's not going to happen.
Yeah, the media definitely is the access that we have to media as independent artists, and I'm talking about you guys too, because you have a show. We're all dealing with the same thing, you know, trying to get the audience, trying to get the attention of people, and trying to cut through. Because at the same time that it's easier for us to make videos and music and books, it's also easier for everybody else to do it too. So that just creates a lot of noise in the field.
It's hard to get through. I wonder. So in podcasting, we have an interesting stat where it's like, so there's about 4 or 5 million podcasts right now. but only 10% of those have been active in the last 6 months. So it's about 1 in 10. The magic number seems to be 7. So it's about 90% of podcasts never get past episode 7. Obviously, that's what the average is and everything else. But so out of a pool of 5 million, you're really talking about 400,000 or 500,000. And then if you sort of subdivide that into the genres, you're probably only competing with, you know, still a lot, thousands to tens of thousands. But I wonder if music is the same way. Music seems a lot more dedicated. I feel like musicians are more dedicated than podcasters. If we were making money, we'd have been out of here by now.
I think that on the whole, that's probably true, that the musicians will put a longer amount of time into doing it, because music is older than podcasting. And podcasting is like a relatively recent phenomenon, right?
Yeah. Is there more from your book that we need to discuss? What else can you tell us about your book?
Well, I'd like people to, first of all, the book was mainly written for musicians, but it's also for all kinds of creative people, because I feel like music is the mother of all the arts. You know, everything, any kind of art that you do uses musical principles. The same musical principles can be applied to dance, to painting, to sculpture, to literature, and even to speaking, right? Public speaking, like you guys do. So in terms of music being the mother of all the arts, I'd like to think that my book is a book that all creative people would want to reference, so that they could employ more musical ideas in their own art. And it's a necessary thing for creative people now to really try to go to the roots of creativity, because what we have is a situation where AI is generating a lot of content now. And a lot of people can't really tell the difference between something that's generated by AI and something that's actually created by an individual artist. On top of that, we have the fact that AI is kind of mining the work that individual artists have been doing for all this time, right? In order to create its own, whatever it's putting out, whether it's visual art or music or writing or what have you. I mean, for me, I can tell if I'm reading something, I can tell if it was written by AI or written by a person. If I'm listening to music, I can tell whether it was generated by an AI program or whether an actual person, an actual artist made that. So I think that artists have to bring more to the table now. And the only way that we can do that is by going the metaphysical route, because metaphysics is the only aspect that AI is never going to get. It can't copy that, because it doesn't have the sentience to understand what metaphysics is all about. So the human artists are going to have to employ that and go deep into themselves and find this interior aspect that is going to deepen whatever offering they are involved in, you know, whether it's music or art or literature.
Do you think there's a chance that it just sort of blows over? Because, I mean, the AI thing ain't going to blow over. But, I mean, the example I would use is that there's not a human on the earth that could beat an AI at chess. And it's been that way for 50 years. You know, the ultimate chess game would be two AIs playing each other, and they could put that on TV and nobody's going to watch it. Nobody's going to pay a dollar on the internet to watch it. But we're still able to sell out these chess competitions. Not my cup of tea, but they still sell out, you know, all over the place to watch humans play chess against each other. So there seems to be something where, yeah, we know that dude can't beat the computer, but we don't care. We're here to watch humans play each other. I think the same thing if we ever got robots that could play football or hockey or baseball. We're just not going to be interested in, we'll watch it once or twice because it's going to be, you know, it'll be a sight to see. Let's go, let's check it out. But then it's sort of just like when the first robot beat the human at chess, you know, everyone's all excited. Let's see, got to watch that. But then the novelty kind of wore off pretty quick. And now we're back to watching people play chess and watching, not only that, we watch people compete at all sorts of stuff. I think that computers are already better than the math, you know, we got math Olympics. We've got spelling bees and all these sorts of things that computers could beat us at, but we'd never be interested in watching it anyway. We're not interested in watching a computer spell things. I mean, the spelling bee, I'm not interested in watching that either, but you know, some people are. So I think that, you know, another example of it would be, I remember when I was a kid that there was this movement where you'd see a cookie in the store and it would be like the marketing would be untouched by human hands. Because basically it was a robot made this whole thing and no dirty human touched the whole thing. But now you do that now in 2025, you put up untouched by human hands beside homemade and tell me which one sells more. You know, it's going to be the homemade one every single time. And I think that is creators, because I mean, we're sort of in the same boat because we're in businesses that are directly up against AI right now, where it's like, you know, we can use it to advance ourselves quickly and do things a lot quicker than we could before, but they could also turn this thing around on us and maybe screw us that way. But then at the end of the day, I always go back to, you know what, you can fool me with an AI voice for 45 seconds or a minute, but when I get to like hour one of an audiobook, it's just not going to happen. And I don't think that all the programming in the world is going to give it the cadence that humans have evolved over. I mean, anatomically, modern humans have spent at least 200,000 years listening to each other. And I think that it's going to take a computer more than a decade to figure that out. So I think
Audible doesn't even allow AI voices.
They did for a while. They did for a while, and then they kiboshed it quickly. And I can only assume it's because they got a bunch of pushback, because we're in the audiobook business pretty heavily. We have a publishing company. So, you know, there was a time when we were personally, it was like, this AI, is it going to push in? Is it going to take over the place? And in the space of about 6 months, they went from like almost pushing you to do an AI voice to now saying, if this is AI, you need to check this fucking box. And I'll tell you right now, if you start checking that box, you're going to have a lot trickier time getting your content through. And the reason I know that is because I have had titles rejected to us just because they thought it might be AI. So they were like, you got to prove that this is not AI. Show us. We've had to send in a video of Graham fucking on video reading a thing so that they knew he was a human and not some robot that we made. So my hope is that this whole thing will sort of blow over in some ways, but the AI is not going anywhere. The same as the internet wasn't going anywhere. And I don't think either are the end of the world. It's just a new thing to figure out.
Well, I think you're right in that the attraction to watching AI do stuff is, you know, quickly fading. But the fact remains that in order for art to evolve, it has to become more, I'm not going to say more complex, but it has to be deeper. It has to be as meaningful as people need it to be now.
Is there any chance that this is what deeper looks like? I'm not saying it is, but the AI ultimately is built by us and is an amalgamation of everything humans have ever built. So if it can make beautiful music or beautiful art, and I'm not saying it can, but do we lose our humanity, or is that because I could see a side where that might be deeper. I might not like it, but it still might be deeper.
Well, look at what people are using it for. You know, I want someone to, you know, wash my dishes and do the housework and, you know, do do the taxes and all that stuff. I don't want the AI to be making my art for me. I want to make the art, right? But now people are using it to like make art. I don't know. It's crazy. To me, and eventually, if you turn over all the creativity to AI, eventually there's going to be no more human activity for it, human creativity for it to mine and harvest. And so it's going to be regurgitating in a endless loop its own stuff.
Yeah, and it'll break then.
That's hallucinating along the way.
There's a word. Yeah. There's a specific word for that.
Entropy.
Entropy. It's going to reach entropy eventually. I mean, that's one of the reasons that I'm like using it as much as I can right now, because it's going to get useless soon. I think it's got like a weird thing where it starts eating its own tail in a sort of weird way that I don't even understand, because I'm not a programmer or anything like that. But I feel like this thing runs into a wall where it starts mining itself, and then it starts to get real weird.
Yeah. I hear you. And that's, I think, going to keep happening. And that's why I wrote the book, because I want people to start thinking about deepening their own creativity so that they can be even more of an artist that can't be imitated by AI or by anyone else for that matter.
Do you use them at all?
I don't think we didn't show the book. Can we show the book?
Yeah. Do you use AI at all?
I do. And you know what I've been interested lately is this AI that Robert Edward Grant created. Okay, I'm going to show my book.
Oh, yeah, good. Yeah, okay. I was going to pull up your website. But yeah, that's awesome. Okay, nice.
Yeah, so this is it. I've been researching this AI called The Architect, because it's a completely different system. It's kind of an offshoot of ChatGPT, except it was programmed by Grant, who's a metaphysics guy, a mathematician. And so it has a completely different set of values, and it's not out there harvesting mediocrity in the same way that ChatGPT or some of these other LLMs are doing.
Or propaganda, for that matter.
Yeah, there you go.
So he has it as a separate, almost a separate database type thing then?
Yeah, he programmed all his own stuff into it.
Yeah.
And that's how it started. And now a lot of people who are more interested in a metaphysical approach and using the AI to access that type of information, but also to illuminate things like coherence and resonance that are, I don't want to say new age, but it's kind of like humanity is evolving, right? And we have to cultivate different qualities in order to enter into whatever this new age is going to turn into.
Which might be what you wrote about. It might be a reverse back to ancient wisdom. I mean, really, that's timeless wisdom. And maybe we've lost that in the Enlightenment. And actually, you even wrote that in your book about the Enlightenment. I mean, you're like, Dick, I don't know why they call it that, because the ancients must have looked at us going like, it's not really the Enlightenment. But we're, you know, maybe this is a, you know, a return back to the timeless wisdom.
Yeah, I'd like to think so. And there's a reason that we call it timeless wisdom, right? Because it's never going to go away. It's the same.
I don't know. I would have said that about gender 10 years ago.
But gender still exists, even though socially we have a more fluid interpretation of it now. But actually, you could say that it was like that in ancient Greece too, you know, where let's say homosexuality was a lot more tolerated than, and then subsequently that was something that became almost outlawed, like they did to Alan Turing in Britain. You know, they nailed him to the cross because he was gay, and he was a war hero. I mean, you know, cracking the Enigma code of the Germans and everything. So there's always this double standard that exists. And now that the recognition of a more fluid gender paradigm is here. I think that's super interesting, and it goes along with the hermetic principle of polarity, whereas instead of looking at things that are opposing each other, you look at how they fluctuate on a spectrum, and sometimes they go closer to one pole and closer to another pole.
Sometimes they're bipolar. Sue, this has been great. Where can everyone get the book? Where can they follow you on social media? Do you have a website? All that sort of fun stuff.
Yeah, my website is sueterry.com, and my name is S-U. It's not S-U-E, so get rid of that E. It's just S-U-T-E-R-R-Y.com. So that's my – I have my books and my records and video and a whole bunch of stuff on there. And then I have a weekly Substack. I publish new articles every Sunday. And that's called Temple of Artists. So people can find that on Substack. And I have my record labels on Bandcamp. And my record label is called Qinote, Q-I-N-O-T-E. And I have a new album with my band, my Ecuadorian band, that's came out really good. We have a string quartet that is accompanying us on half of the album. And so there's a lot of creative stuff going on, and no AI.
What's that called? What's that called? The album, is that Gilly's Caper or no?
No, that one is called Apu, and it's with my group Jazz De Barro.
Nice.
Yeah, cool. Can you pull it up?
I can. Yeah, I can try. I've got your website here, right here, and that's why I went to Spotify over there. I'm sorry, not Spotify, but Bandcamp. But where do I find it on here then? In music or? Oh, yeah, there it is. Apu, right there. Right there.
Yeah, that's the new album.
Yeah. Oh, cool. Very cool.
Yeah, we're proud of that. It came out really good.
Excellent.
Look at all.
Oh, and the book people can find on Amazon. They can get it in Kindle, or they can get a paperback copy of it. And my other books are up there too.
Awesome. Sue, this has been great. We appreciate you coming back on the show and sticking with it through the technical difficulties.
Thanks a lot, guys. I always love talking to you both. And hopefully we'll see you soon.
Okay, thanks. Take care.
Stay safe.
Thank you. You too.
And that was our chat with Sue Terry, Music and the Seven Hermetic Principles. What do you think?
Yeah, I forgot to mention the yin yang. It's mentioned a couple times in her book, but I wasn't sure if she was aware that Bob Greenier's found that molecular, like that real microscopic yin yang happening at the transmutation of materials or some sort of like modern alchemical process. I feel like that's an interesting, another one of these timeless wisdom things, right? The yin yang's been so popular, now it's being proven by modern science. So
we should have him back on the show soon.
Yeah, we should.
Big thanks to Sue for coming on the show. Big thanks to you guys, of course, for listening. Even bigger thanks, went a little Indian there, listening. Thanks for listening. Even bigger thanks if you're one of our supporters or nobles in Grimerica at grimerica.ca/support, where you can sign up for a monthly or make a one-time donation today. It keeps the show going. If we run out of supporters, we'll probably run out of shows shortly thereafter. So you could be part of the producing team of Grimerica at grimerica.ca/support. We appreciate you keeping us on the air for 12 years. So keep that going. Check out contact@thecabin.com for trips and events. We got some good ones coming up in the next year. Serpent Mound, Azores, Easter Island. We got Adult Brain. Do you see the thing I added to Contact at the Cabin? I had a little blurb.
Yeah, I saw it. Yeah.
I felt like we had nothing, you know, it was just like bleh.
Yeah.
So check that out. contact@thecabin.com, adultbrain.ca for 179 now audiobooks.
There's available the book Sue was talking about
in podcast form, or you can get them on YouTube, or you can get them in Spotify or Audible or wherever, any place you get your audiobooks probably. What am I missing? Grimerica CBD.com for gummies and tinctures and all of that sort of fun stuff. Did I kick my power cord over my mic? It started buzzing. And I think that's it, right?
Yep.
That's it. We love you guys. Thanks for listening. And we will see you next week.
Five pink flamingos and a few flamenco dancers. They're in the kitchen and they're baking Day of the Dead cookies. And I step into the kitchen and I'm like, let me have a looky, see what kind of cookie you're cooking up. And they're looking up at me skeptical, and I point next to my spectacles. And I'm wearing a maroon Harvard t-shirt. Yeah, I know I'm a smart cookie, but I'm no psychic. You can come and ring my bell, but where we're gonna end up in the future, I can never tell. I can never tell. Me and five of my best friends and a few of my enemies, we're at the coffee shop, settling our differences. Benjamin Otto pulls out a game of Chinese checkers, and he orders a cappuccino, and I pick blue and he picks red and you pick yellow. And I'm wearing a tie-dye peace sign t-shirt. Yeah, I know I'm a peacenik, but I ain't no hypocrite. You can come and ring my bell, but where we're gonna end up in the future, I can never tell. I can never tell. One bell, one man, and with my sense of smell, I can smell the salt in your tears. I can sense your fears. You're hoping for a bit of divinity in this worldly vicinity. And you understand the fragility of the human vessel. And you sit Indian style like a pretzel. And you levitate to a transcendental state when you meditate. And you levitate to a transcendental state when you meditate. And you levitate to a transcendental state.